The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, hello. Thank you. I'm going to take this off because it's going to do this annoyingly all evening long. It's like a striptease act. Really, really slow and uninteresting one. So Tang, I love the Tang touch. Tang is one of many commercial off-the-shelf products that NASA employs. You know, NASA makes a lot of stuff on their own, but then they buy a bunch of supermarket-type stuff and repackage it. And one of the items that's commercial off-the-shelf is the diapers that they use in the spacewalk. When they, you know, they're wearing the big white suit and they're out there, and you can't go to the bathroom, so you got the diapers. Those are actually a product, and I'm not making this up. This is an adult diaper called Rejoice. I don't think it's made anymore, and I actually thought that they'd made this up because it was just such a, who calls an adult diaper Rejoice? Anyway, so this book is, this is a little different than your average space book. Space books, a lot of them tend to be kind of astronaut memoirs. There's a lot of heroics and bravery. Everybody's all boldly going and boldly coming back and, you know, like Apollo 13, Captain Lovell and his brave crew fighting for their lives on the way to the moon when there was a power outage. And I actually interviewed Captain Lovell, but not about Apollo 13. I called him about Gemini 7. Gemini 7, like most of the Gemini program, this was kind of dress rehearsal for the moonshot. You know, we're talking about working out the kinks, seeing it's, you know, 2 weeks. This is a longer time than anybody's been up there. And Gemini 7 was a restricted hygiene mission. This was really two men, 2 weeks, no shower, in a suit. And, like, what will that do to the human organism? Like, is it too much to ask of someone? What, you know? I call this chapter, Houston, We Have a Fungus. And there's this wonderful point in the mission transcript. NASA has all these, you know, the surface-to-air communications, everything that was said is all, you can, you know, go through these PDFs, and it's just the back and forth between the astronauts and ground control. And, you know, 90% of it is sort of jargon, but then you get these moments, like in Gemini 7, where you hear the surgeon, flight surgeon, he comes on the microphone speaking to Frank Borman, who's the commander. Gemini 7, this is flight surgeon. Have you had any dandruff problem up there, Frank? Which is, dandruff is a word you really don't expect to see in a mission transcript. And also lotion. Lotion, you know, two guys orbiting the Earth talking about skincare. There would be times when the flight surgeon would come on, and you could just, like, Frank Borman would just ignore him. You know, they're just like, I really don't want to discuss skincare. It was like it was compromising the overall manliness of the mission. But you had to feel bad for them because it's zero G. Dandruff does not fall. Dandruff just kind of floats. And I asked Captain Lovell about this. I think my exact words were, was it just like a snow globe in there? He said, Mary, you're investigating a rather unusual aspect of space flight. So anyway, this book is about astronaut life. It's about life in the void, but it's also about this very surreal world of simulated space travel. It's about life in space, but also space on Earth, because space is so foreign and hostile and incredibly weird and expensive, and because zero gravity turns everything on its head, there are these elaborate, expensive simulations here on Earth. Like, for example, the Gemini 7 was, in a sense, a simulation of a moon mission, but even before that, there were these studies that went on at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in the Space Cabin Simulator. And these were these, you know, the students from Dayton University who brought over, paid money to sit in a small room with the heat turned up, wearing a spacesuit and some underwear, and then they would document where the bacteria was going and how bad their armpits smelled and what was going on with their scalps. And it was just this very, very surreal, bizarre thing to be doing. And they even tried to get Frank Borman and Lovell, they tried to get them to do a simulation before Gemini, just sort of sitting in two flight seats, and Frank Borman's like, we got that crap kicked out real fast. They would have nothing to do with that. By way of example, when I say that space makes, zero gravity makes just everything that you do strange or impossible, an example that I use is the toilet, because the toilet on Earth makes use of two things, gravity and water. And on a long mission, you know, water is in short supply, and you have no gravity. So you don't – whoa, they warned me about the little – whoo. So you have a situation where you've got to come up with another way good separation is what – this is sort of the holy grail of the waste management department at NASA, because you've got you know, you probably haven't thought about – given any thought to this, but when, you know, when you're on the toilet, you have this growing mass, and the growing mass – you know, on Earth has weight, and it's the weight that pulls it away and lets it go forth onto its own into the toilet. Well, in space, it just kind of hovers. And separation is a serious issue. Separation, this chapter is called Separation Anxiety. Because it's – and before there were – you know, in the first – the capsule flights, Mercury – well, Mercury, nobody had to go because it was a few hours. But Gemini and Apollo – There's no bathroom. There's a bag. And, okay, a bag, not, that wouldn't be too bad, but, you know, you've got to provide the separation. There's a finger cot. And this was a tremendous morale buster. This was a situation. Astronauts came back, and the one thing they all complained about was the fecal bags. There's this wonderful quote. I don't know who said it, but it was after some meeting where they were getting feedback from the Apollo crews, and they were all telling their horror stories of the fecal bags, because you also had to mush back germicide into it. And see, it was just, anyway, the quote was, we have to do better. So they did do better. Eventually we got a bigger, you know, bigger spaceship, actual toilet, and had to totally rethink it. It works like a shop vac. It's basically airflow, and you are entraining the bolus. That's the lovely euphemism. One of many that the waste management systems engineers have come up with at NASA. You're entraining the bolus, kind of like, you know, whoosh, away it goes. But now the problem becomes, okay, you have to test this toilet, and it's a big elaborate thing, the size of a washing machine. And you got to make sure it works in zero gravity. Because if you send it up there thinking, oh, hopefully it'll work, you know, that could be a disaster, a very expensive disaster. So they haul the whole thing over to Ellington Field. They put it on a weightless flight, which is this plane that's doing these parabolic arcs like this. And from here to here, you have like 20 seconds of zero G. Think about that. Maybe not too hard, though. you got 22 seconds and in which to produce. And that, you know, for – okay, if you've got to pee, one thing, but the other stuff, and there were these poor guys, everybody's were like cheering and like, go, 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 go. So eventually NASA realized that it would be easier to actually, they have some rheologists, R-H-E-O-L-O, something G-L, I say, rheologists. These guys were given the task to come up with simulants. Fecal simulants. And there's whole papers on these are very, very realistic. They could have just gone to the diaper industry and said, hey, what do you guys use? And the answer would be disconcertingly edible things like mashed potatoes, pumpkin pie filling, brownie mix. That's what the diaper industry has used in the past. But NASA, being NASA, made their own. And actually, it's got it is one-third by weight E. coli, which matches – get yeah. I know. Anyway, even with all the simulations, you still have unexpected things happening. You know, the shuttle toilet was tested and was deemed ready to go, and they take it up there, and then they had this problem, and it became known as fecal popcorning. And this was a horrible thing. I mean, it's funny, but it's not. It was these pieces of freeze-dried material in the bowl because it's airflow. It's kind of, picture an air popcorn popper. And little bits would break off, and they're just flying all around like, in an air pop popper. And because you have zero gravity, you've got a situation where some of it, is going to, you have escapees. And that's why there's a rear-view mirror to make sure there's nothing escaping. Which brings me to my favorite line in the book, which is two words separated by a comma, howdy-doody. I thought I would read you something, and then... I have a few more things to talk about it, but I do want, questions are really fun because it will take us to some, maybe I can find out what you're interested in. Perhaps you're not really interested in the toilet aspect. Perhaps it's just me that finds this fascinating. But while I'm talking about it, I do have one more. I want to read you a passage, and this is my first talk, so I'm kind of just sort of working it through here, so please bear with me. Okay, this is... Apollo 16, which is John Young and Charlie Duke, and they are sitting in the lunar module Orion. I'm going to put on my old person spectacles. They're sitting, and they've been out collecting rocks, as is their duty, on the moon. Okay, and during a radio debriefing with Mission Control, and this is, again, all in the transcripts, out of the blue, Young declares, "I got the farts again. I got them again, Charlie. I don't know what the hell gives them to me. I think it's acid in the stomach." Following Apollo 15, in which low potassium levels were blamed for heart arrhythmias of the crew, NASA had put potassium-laced orange, grapefruit, and other citrus drinks, Tang, on the menu. Young kept going. It's all there in the mission transcript. "I mean, I haven't eaten this much citrus in 20 years. And I'll tell you one thing, another 12 fucking days, I ain't never eating any more." "And if they offer to serve me potassium with my breakfast, I'm going to throw up. I like an occasional orange. I really do. But I'll be damned if I'm going to be buried in oranges." Moments later, Mission Control comes on the line and provides Young with yet more fodder for indigestion. "Capcom," that's the capsule communicator, the guy at Mission Control. "Orion, this is Houston." Young says, "Yes, sir." "Okay, you have a hot mic." Young says, "Oh." "How long have we had that?" "Capcom, it's been on through the debriefing." This time, it wasn't Congress that got riled. It was the day after Young's comments hit the press. The governor of Florida issued a statement in defense of his state's key crop, which Charlie Duke paraphrases in his memoir. "It is not our orange juice that is causing the trouble. It is an artificial substitute that does not come from Florida." In fact, it was the potassium, not the orange juice. The coefficient of flatulence, quote unquote, for orange juice, to use the terminology of USDA flatus researcher Edwin Murphy, another panelist at the 1964 Conference on Nutrition in Space and Related Waste Problems, is low. That is the coefficient of flatulence. Murphy reported on research he had done using an experimental bean meal fed to volunteers who had been rigged via a rectal catheter to outgas into a measurement device. Murphy was interested in individual differences, not just in overall volume of flatus, but in the differing percentages of constituent gases. Owing to differences in intestinal bacteria, half the population produces no methane. This makes them attractive as astronauts, not because methane stinks, it is odorless, but because it is highly flammable. Murphy had a unique suggestion for the NASA Astronaut Selection Committee. Quote, "The astronaut may be selected from that part of our population producing little or no methane or hydrogen," hydrogen also explosive, "and a very low level of hydrogen sulfide and other malodorous trace flatus constituents not yet identified. They actually wanted to build into the selection criteria for the astronaut corps what kind of gas do they produce. let's see. And then he comes across a particular interest, says Murphy, for further research was the subject who produced essentially no flatus on 100 grams dry weight of beans, as opposed to the average gut, which will, during peak flatulence period, 5 to 6 hours post-bean consumption, pass anywhere from almost one to almost three cups of flatus per hour. As an alternative to recruiting the constitutionally non-flatulent, NASA could create non-producers by sterilizing their digestive tract. Murphy had fed the notorious bean meal to a subject who was taking antibacterial drugs and found that the man expelled 50% less gas. The saner approach, and the one that NASA actually took, was to simply avoid your high coefficient of flatus foods. This is a quote from a retired food scientist at NASA. Beans were not used until shuttle. There are those who welcomed their arrival, and not just because they're tasty. The zero-gravity fart has been a popular orbital pursuit, particularly on all-male flights. One hears tell of astronauts using intestinal gas like rocket propellant to, quote, launch themselves across the middeck, as astronaut Roger Crouch put it. He had heard, this is somebody who actually returned my emails. He had heard the claims and was dubious. This is Roger Crouch in his email. The mass and velocity of the expelled gas is very small compared to the mass of the human body. Thus, it was unlikely that it could accelerate a 180-pound astronaut. Crouch pointed out that an exhaled breath doesn't propel an astronaut in any direction, and the lungs hold about 6 liters of air versus the fart, which, as we learned from Dr. Murphy, holds at most 3 soda cans worth. Crouch went on. He decided to do his own private experiment. My genes, he says, have blessed me with an extraordinary ability to expel some of the byproducts of digestion. So given that, I thought it should be tested. In what I thought was a real voluminous and rapidly expelled purge, I failed to move noticeably. Crouch was heading to Cape Canaveral and promised to ask around for some other astronauts' input, but so far no one is, as they say, spilling the beans. Thank you. Thanks. I want to leave plenty of time for questions because there's just so much. When I flew out here, I hadn't looked at the book in a while, and I reread the book, and I made flashcards, and I've just crammed so much of this stuff in my head. It's all sort of bursting out. So if you are you're curious about anything at all about, you know, mostly the human side of space travel, not necessarily the rocket science. I'm not very good at that. But really, I'd be happy to take questions, and we have our lovely assistant with the microphone. It could be about food. It could be about the psychological aspects of, you know, and particularly with a Mars mission, which is, you know, 2.5 years. It could be something about Ham and Enos. I have a whole lovely chapter on them, the space chimps. Anything at all that you might have a question about? Oh, my private life.
Okay. We'll start here on our right.
Welcome to Philadelphia.
Thank you.
One question as far as, you know, extended space flight. How are they doing on the issues of muscle wasting mm-hmm. and loss of bone density?
Yes, that's a great question. That's a serious issue. When you're going on a long, like Mars mission, I've heard a projection. Well, let me just back up a little bit. When you're in zero gravity and you're not putting any weight on your skeleton and you're not using your muscles because you're not walking, you're floating, you're flying, your body basically says, you know, we don't really need this stuff, so let's kind of break it down. So you have a tremendous amount of muscle atrophy and bone loss on a short duration mission, up to 15%, which is a pretty spectacular amount of bone loss. And on a Mars mission, 2.5 years, the bone expert I talked to said a third to 50%, and that's a crazy amount of loss. And, of course, when you go, you put your weight back on, you do gain some back. But that's why they have these bed rest facilities where they mimic zero gravity. They have people like lying in bed for 3 months and they're using drugs, exercise. The exercise is really tough because you're essentially bungee corded to a treadmill. So there's a lot of sort of chafing and cursing, and it's very unwieldy and squeaky and not terribly effective. It's only like you only have about 70% of your weight even then. So it remains a problem. They don't have a good solution. Yeah.
Lady on our left here.
I had read just a little bit of the sample chapter I got at a conference earlier about the Japanese and the thousand crane psychological.
Yes.
You know, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, sure. Yes. I spent some time at the Japanese Space Agency, and they were recruiting new astronauts. They're going to bring in one or two new astronauts to the astronaut corps. They had 10 finalists, and they had them in an isolation chamber where they were living for a week and being observed by psychiatrists, psychologists, and administrators from JAXA. And I got there one day. I really didn't know what to expect. I kind of thought they would do things like, there's a fire in the kitchen. What are you going to do? That kind of thing. But it was much more subtle. They, at one point, opened these envelopes, and there were these brightly colored pieces of paper, and it was origami paper. And it was this exercise called 1,000 Cranes, which is a traditional Japanese, you make 1,000 cranes, string them, and give them to hospital patients. It's a good luck thing for people who are ill. But each astronaut would have to make 100 cranes, string them, and then the psychiatrists would look at compare the first cranes to the later cranes and see, it was a test of accuracy under pressure. And can they focus on a repetitive task? Because a lot of what you're doing in space is fairly repetitive. You know, you may be tightening some bolts or you can't be the kind of person that gets sloppy further along, like me. So it was fascinating. You know, it was just the last thing you would expect to see astronauts applicants for an astronaut test doing. And they were all pretty good. They were pretty. One of them was much better than the rest. And I was so sure I had chosen. I had nailed which guy they were going to choose. He wasn't even in the running. Yeah, but he was really good with his origami. Hopefully, that will find him some other career.
Yeah. Right here in the front row.
Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hey,
Susan.
When you were reporting the book, you were investigating, or starting to investigate anyway, sex in space?
Yes.
Did anything ever turn up?
Oh, sex in space, yes. I have a chapter on sex in space. It's really, it's about zero gravity mating. And I ended up, I did talk to some astronauts, and there is some stuff about actual astronauts, but I interviewed some marine biologists who study the mating habits of earless seals and otters who mate while floating in water, just to see is sex without gravity really, really great, or is it really a pain in the ass? And so, as it turns out, the mammals who mate while floating actually have a lot of difficulty. They're kind of like grabbing each other. Otters sort of grab the female's nose and it's very tricky. There's also some scuba sex website where the guy like floats down, so you got something to push against. So gravity is your friend when it comes to sex. There is much more. There's the whole sex has its own chapter there. So yes, there's much, much, much more.
Right here in the fourth row.
Do the astronauts have any trouble sleeping in space?
Yes, sleeping in space is when you listen to NASA TV sometimes, which is that wonderful nerdy feed from the space station, which I love. It's not in our cable channel, but when I'm in Houston, I watch NASA TV, and they'll say things like the astronauts are in the pre-sleep phase, and at 11:58 they will go to sleep, arising like exactly 8 hours later. Well, who sleeps like that? Nobody sleeps. And thus they're all like they're working hard. They're incredibly. It's exciting. It's stressful. Sleep meds. They definitely are relying on sleep medication because you're sleep deprived. There's something they call the space stupids, which is a combination of stress, sleep deprivation, and just all the other things that astronauts have to deal with that makes them sometimes kind of forgetful. And it's been dubbed space stupids, which, I imagine they're not particularly stupid. But anyway, sleeping is very difficult. And also the fact that you don't have a pillow. Some people find that really, they'll like sort of strap a pillow to have something here because it's just odd to be kind of like, and they have a bag that they sort of they can crawl into, and it's hooked onto the wall. Yeah, so they're kind of bivouacked. Yeah.
Right here in the third row.
I imagine that each flight or shuttle mission has had, because of the different people that are in it, different kind of group dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
Have there been space flights from hell and then ones that have been really, really well done just by nature of who's there? And also, do men and women make it better, a combination, or worse?
Well, I'll answer the last part first. Men and women making it better or worse. There was Antarctica is a nice analog, and they've actually used it because it's isolated and you're confined with the same a small group of people. And for a long time, they're like, we can't have women down here. It'll be everybody will be competing, and there'll be all kinds of fist fights, and it'll be the first time they brought women down, they brought down like a 50-year-old woman who was in her photograph wearing like a cross, and she's very and a nun. The other one was a nun. So like, yeah, okay, we have women here. Yeah, we have women here. So, but then, you know, gradually they brought more and more women until the ratio was, I don't know, do you know what the ratio is in Antarctica? Hey, it's probably not 50-50, but anyway. And they found that everybody was happier. There was just, people weren't sort of, it's beneficial. It's been found to be not, there isn't the sort of, you know, jealousy, competition, fist fights, or all the things that people envisioned. In fact, they found that women had kind of a stabilizing. There were fewer fart jokes. That's what one person told me. Fewer people sort of competing to be macho and lifting too heavy of a box. People tended to shower more often. So in space, I imagine it's similar. I mean, it took a long time for women. Interestingly, the excuse that was given for why women did not go into space for so long was that we would have to figure out like the whole hygiene toilet issue. We'd have to, we got to like completely rejigger this thing, and we're in a hurry. We're trying to get to the moon. Let's just simplify. So it was interesting that was a big consideration. What was the first? I knew this would happen. Oh, yeah, the group dynamics are. That's one thing when they're choosing astronauts. One of the important components is they bring the finalists in to just sort of hang time with the astronauts. Just to see, you know, how does everybody get along? Because, you know, you're not just choosing someone for the mission. You're choosing someone you're going to work very closely with for years. You know, maybe in mission control, maybe in, you know, other aspects of parts of NASA. And so the interpersonal dynamic is really important. And the thing with once you're in space, they've trained together for months. So anything that's not working out would have been sort of, they would have sort of caught that on the ground. So I didn't hear of very many, especially these days. There are tales of old Russian flights where there were major problems. Like, you know, there's a Diary of a Cosmonaut is this wonderful book. And through much of it, the two men are just not speaking. It's very sad. Just like, haven't spoken to Tolya in 2 weeks now. which can you imagine the stress? And you're soaking in it. You can't slam the door and go for a drive. So what happens is when you're frustrated and you're angry, you either take it out on someone else or you internalize it, and then it becomes depression, and that is an issue, particularly with long, like some of the Mir flights, the astronauts were very depressed. Yeah.
How about five rows back in the yellow, six rows?
In a number of the science fiction stories, they suggest that anything just floating around, like pens or what have you, will tend to end up at the exhaust filters. Does that actually happen?
Yes. Yes. That's the only way anyone ever finds anything that they've lost in space. If it weren't for those filters, you would, like, and even then, you know, there was one, Andy Thomas, who was on Mir, said, you know, I brought one nail file, and about 2 weeks before I came down, I let go of it for a second, gone, never saw it again. He said they lost an entire Sharps container, which is a fairly sizable thing. Just like never saw it again. Drifted off. And I guess too heavy to make it to the filter. But anyway, yes, that does happen. Yeah.
Gentleman in the orange there.
Yep, you're right.
Excuse me. Hi, could you comment on the space chimps and their relevance to the entire space program, please?
Yes, absolutely. Ham and Enos. I spoke to Ham was the chimp that preceded Alan Shepard in a suborbital flight. Enos actually orbited before John Glenn, which really bugged Alan Shepard and John Glenn. There was this the reason that they went up, they wanted to, because they had these routines, these button pushing routines, and there was a concern that first of all that something strange might happen to their cognition and they might not, you know, that the astronauts might not be able to perform. So they gave the chimps sort of complex tasks to do and make sure they could still do them. Also, they wanted, you know, because when you've got, you know, when you're going through reentry, you've got a certain amount of XSG. So your arm becomes heavier, and it wasn't known whether, like with 8 Gs, you can't even lift your arm. So they wanted to see, and chimps is, that's not really a great, chimps are much stronger, but they wanted to be sure the chimps could, you know, do these various things that the astronauts would be doing. The astronauts, of course, were like, for God's sake, skip the chimps. Just let us go. I mean, these are fighter jocks. You know, these are guys who are like, man, I haven't been in space, but I've been pretty close. Just, you know, let us go up there. So it was and they didn't, the trainers of the chimps, I said, did you guys hang out with John Glenn and Alan Shepard? He's like, he said, they didn't like to acknowledge that we really existed. And at one point they plotted, there was this they used the same little van to go out to the gantry for launch. And they had, I think it was Alan Shepard's trajectory there. And one of the chimps trainers plotted Ham's, which was higher and farther. He said, they pulled that card down so fast. So there was a certain rivalry. It's a fascinating story. Yeah.
About 7 rows back there, gentleman on the aisle.
Can you tell me, are there still a lot of perspective or a lot of interest in being an astronaut? Are people, like you mentioned, the depression, maybe mm-hmm. with more awareness of the difficulties of flight, there are less people that are really wanting to go up? Or do people still want to repeat a lot?
I don't have figures for you, but I think there's still a tremendous number of people who apply. I don't think they're having any trouble filling the spaces in the astronaut corps. Of course, now, who knows, you know, what the future is going to be. There's actually private companies posting ads for astronauts. The Bigelow Corporation, I think, had an ad on. I don't know if it was Craigslist or if, like, astronaut wanted. Wow. I think people, it's like backpacking, you know, it's despite all the hassles and the discomfort and the restricted hygiene and all that other stuff and the lack of sleep, just to be where they are is so appealing to a certain kind of person. I mean, I love backpacking, even though it's a pain. Some people go, why do you want to sleep in a tent? Why would you want to do that? And I'm like, because you get up there in the mountains and there's no one around and it's this unbelievable view. And I think that still appeals to people. I think so. I'm kind of guessing, though.
Let's keep going back, lady in the... Yes, Violet on the aisle.
I think this is a good lead-in from the question you just answered. I've been reading a lot about proposed reductions in federal funding for mm-hmm. space travel and worries about the U.S. falling behind the international community in spaceflight, and given all your journeys right. along with NASA-funded FLATIS experts, do you meet folks who have opinions about federal dollars versus the innovation and dollars from the private sector?
Oh, everyone has an opinion, yeah. I mean, I have on my Gmail homepage NASA Watch, which is a website which is, you know, people inside NASA, and not all inside, but, you know, some outside, and it's these, you know, debates back and forth about, and it's a very, people have very, very, very strong feelings about it. I mean, you didn't ask my opinion, but it is incredibly expensive, and it is hard to justify it just for the science when you can have robotic landers, but... I mean, I would love to see it be a global effort, which is essentially the International Space Station has been up there for 10 years. And although they're doing all kinds of interesting science, it's really a very elaborate exercise in global space cooperation. And it's been incredibly successful in that way. And the point of it was, let's see what it takes to live in space for a long time, because one day we want to go to Mars. So for me, it's just to get that far and to have put everything into it and then stop seems very sad. Yes, and I love to think that, you know, if you got all these different nations involved and helping to fund it, and that it could be done one day. But and private, you know, I think a mix of private companies and NASA. I mean, it already exists because you have Boeing and you have all these various contractors who are private companies who are actually building the thing. So it really the mix already exists and it can work very well. Yeah. I don't know if that answered your question.
So this kind of goes off in a different direction. What happens if a female astronaut has her period in space? Is it like just having a period on Earth, or are there like special procedures?
That's a great question, and I'll tell you the anecdote that women do have. It works the same way. But the story that I heard, which cracked me up, was this woman astronaut. I even forget who it was, but she's going into her personal kit to get some tampons out, and because it's zero gravity, they've tied them all together, kind of like sausages. And she's described like pulling them out, and they kept coming and coming and coming. She said, obviously a man packed this bag. There's like 100 tampons for a 2-week flight. So thank you for asking that question.
Lady right here.
Isn't there a bicycle or something they use to give them exercise on the space?
Yes, there's all manner of torture devices up there. There are bicycles. There've been different types. There's bicycles. There've been treadmills with the bungee to sort of pull you into the what is it called? The mill. The track. There's weight devices, resistance training. Yeah, definitely. You have special exercise clothes because that's when you get really sweaty. And it's fortunate that they give those to you because this, Sandy Magnus, I think it was, told me they calculate for, you have one change of underwear every 2 days. She said, but I was able to extend it to from 5 to 7 days. So you definitely, you need to exercise, yeah. They do like 2 hours a day or something like that on the space station. Yeah.
Gentleman in the brown and white shirt.
Thank you. How would they deal with the effects of radiation, long space flights, for example, for Mars?
Once you're away from the Earth's protective atmosphere, you've got to deal with cosmic radiation and solar events, and you can have some pretty scary radiation levels, and it's cumulative. So a Mars mission is I think the biggest concern. And the way that I heard, and with a Mars mission, if you're talking about shielding, that's going to add a lot of weight. So one ingenious approach that has been bandied around is that you would use the food on the way out. You'd put the food as the sort of radiation shielding along. You're basically flying in a can of food and eating it along the way. And then on the way back, when you've eaten a lot of your radiation shielding, you would then actually use your feces. That would be put in, like, there's a device at NASA Ames where it's like an easy bake oven kind of. You kind of make these little tiles with garbage and feces, and because hydrocarbons are good at as radiation shielding, so you would fly home in the can of shit.
The orange.
This kind of relates to that. I'm curious how astronaut food has changed over the last 45 years.
Astronaut food has changed tremendously. It started out as little, very dry, very nutrient-dense, very unappealing, like meat bites and egg cubes and peanut cubes, and they would be rehydrated with your own saliva by holding them in the mouth for 10 seconds, and the astronauts hated them. And they had these, because you don't want crumbs in space, you don't want little bits floating around and getting in your eye or getting in the instrumentation, they had these sort of waxy coatings on them which stuck to the roof of your mouth and just apparently really unpleasant. And now, partly because, back then we're talking about a very small capsule, you don't want a lot of weight, so you want them to be not take up a lot of space and not be heavy. But now you've got plenty of room on the shuttle and the space station. So the food is goopy food that you heat. You just sort of stick in and heat it up. It's been thermostabilized to kill germs, so it's got a very long shelf life. So that messes with the taste a bit, but it isn't bad. I haven't tried a lot of it, but I've tried a little of it, and it's okay. It's kind of like cafeteria food. Yeah.
What did you eat?
It was some hash browns. They were doing a taste test of hash browns. That was what I had. And I've tried some of the tubed food. I tried a tube of sloppy Joe. And it's very disconcerting to eat sloppy Joe from a tube. I mean, because you want some Joe, you know? It's just kind of pureed sauce. It's kind of baby food. It's like baby food. The mercury stuff on the tube, that was just baby food. Yeah.
Right here in the second row.
So I assume most of the time they're working, sleeping, eating, but is there any socialization? Do they play games? Do they watch TV? I mean,
yeah.
Music? What are they, what is that?
Yes, there's, well, one of the things I loved is that on all the space stations, there's a table, a kitchen table. Even though a table makes no sense, you put something down, it floats away. And they took the table away at one point, and they said, no, we want a table. We want, at the end of the day, to gather around a table and hang out and talk about the day. So give us our table back. I know it's stupid, but we want a table. And so they have tables. And so, gathering around and eating a meal such as it is really important. People bring up musical instruments, guitars. Someone brought up a Japanese astronaut had a karaoke machine. Someone else was throwing a boomerang, which seemed really like a dangerous thing to be doing on the space shuttle. But so anything that, definitely people bring an iPod, with their own music selection. And so anything portable and games. I think on a shuttle mission, there's not a ton of downtime, but on a longer, like on a space station where you could be up there 6 months or more, you'll have time for recreation such as it is. I mean, soccer, not going to be. Also, flying. They'll do, where you start at one end of a module and there's a hatch that's, like that, and you try to, push off and, go through without touching the sides, which would be so much fun, I would imagine. Yeah. Yeah.
About seven rows back on the aisle here.
Going back to the sleeping in zero gravity, I'm curious if any astronauts have ever talked about how sleeping in zero gravity affected their dreams. Like, is every dream about falling or?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't remember anybody saying they dreamed about falling. But I think that I remember saying that you start dreaming in zero G, where you are not walking but floating. In the same same way when you move to a foreign country and start speaking a foreign language, at a certain point you start to dream in that language. They do transition to floating as the way of moving through their dreams. Yeah.
I assume you think it's realistic that there will be manned flights to Mars. And what other major problems do you see in those kind of flights?
Getting back up off the surface, bringing along enough fuel to then, to get back up off the surface and power your flight home is, as far as I understand it, the biggest challenge. So much so that there's been talk about a one-way mission where you would send older astronauts who are, they've had, they're like, the stoics, like, do you laugh? But it's like, there's a few like in their 60s, say, who were, the radiation is they've had their children. The radiation, if they do get exposed to a dose of radiation, the cancer wouldn't kick in for probably 20 years. So for them, and these are people who their life's dream would be to have gone to Mars. So if they end up dying on Mars, they're like A-OK with it. And there are astronauts Dunbar, I think, mentioned that, and also the first woman in space, Tereshkova, told Putin, "I'm ready to go to Mars. I'm ready." And to stay, you'd send unmanned resupply landers to supply them. I guess is the way it would be done. So anyway, but the return trip, I'm told, is the most problematic thing, plus the radiation issue.
In the yellow here,
Can you talk a little bit how you developed your interest in writing about?
Yes. I did a story for Discover magazine some years ago called Two Men in a Tub, which was about the neutral buoyancy tank at Johnson Space Center, which is that huge, huge swimming. It's like a swimming pool on steroids, enormous, where they've submerged pieces of the International Space Station so that astronauts can put on their full suit and float in the water and rehearse their tasks. And, you know, for like a 6-hour EVA, you're talking 250 hours of rehearsal. So they've just done everything they're going to do up there, down here. And I was like, wow, that's just this whole scene that I hadn't even imagined. So that's what got me interested originally. Yeah.
Get this gentleman right here in the front row.
You have written about some unusual topics. What's made your books so good to read is your dry sense of humor. You inform us, but you also entertain us, and I thank you for that.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And right here in the second row.
How do you come up with your titles? And this is a really long one.
It is. It's, I know. Packing for, it's four syllables. this one, yeah, we tried to come up with something snappy and edgy and space related and failed. If you guys have any ideas, maybe we could change it for the paperback, but it was hard, you know. Zoom, blast, space, we couldn't come up with anything. We were stumped. I just come up with them by, you know, brainstorming on a piece of paper, and my editor and I will get on the phone and I'll say, oh, I've got a really good one. She'll go, that's a terrible title. And I will do the same for her. And then eventually we settle on something. Yeah.
Well, a lot of questions still. On the aisle here in the green.
Just wondered if you could talk more about how you know a topic has potential to be one of your books, and if there are ideas that you're thinking about doing.
Yeah, well, for me, people say, how do you choose a topic? For me, it's more a lengthy process of eliminating many, many topics and there's just a few things standing. Because I want to have some science in it. I like there to be places that I can go and describe, so it can't be totally abstract. I like there to be some interesting history, because I love to do a little bit of, I can't do a whole historical book because I'm not a historian. So I want some science, some history, some humor, some quirkiness. So there are not that many things that really have all that. So that's the hardest part for me. Always welcome to suggestions. MaryRoach.net. Give me suggestions. Yeah.
Right here, second in.
You talked about the period and going to the bathroom. What about vomiting in space?
Aha!
Yes. Is it easier to get motion sickness?
Yes, there's a whole chat. This chapter is called Throwing Up and Down. yes, space motion sickness affects 50 to 75% of astronauts in the first few days. And unlike me on the vomit comet, they don't take drugs because that would just delay their adaptation. So they just have to tough it out for a few days, and it's miserable. And there's also the very real concern that if you are going on a spacewalk and you happen to get sick, not that you're going to drown in your vomit like some people say, because you have a cough reflex, so you would, if you inhaled it, you would cough it out. But the splatter on the visor could be life-threatening. It really could. And they've done simulations. With, believe it, yes, using Progresso vegetable soup. Yeah.
Are there any other questions in the back there? There's a gentleman on your left.
We've always heard that NASA has a tendency to over-engineer things, spending lots of money on a pen that writes upside down while the Russians say, use a pencil in here. Are we facing some type of toilet gap? How do the Russians do it?
Actually, I think the toilets on the ISS are Russian design, because the Russians, yes, the folks at NASA at a certain point said, you know what, let's just go with, it's simple, it works, let's go with what the Russians, it doesn't have any bells and whistles, but the Russian approach, it creeps in from time to time, and it is, if it works, don't mess with it. They've got, you look on the, on Mir, there's a mock-up of Mir in Moscow in the Museum of Cosmonautics, and there's a fan, and it's just this piece of metal with leather flaps, and it's, it's very simple, worked, and why mess with it? Yeah.
Yeah, gentleman in the blue hat.
Oh, yes.
Okay, have NASA done any studies that if the common cold couldn't survive in space, and can astronauts catch a cold in space?
Well, astronauts are usually spend a duration in quarantine. I don't know if, I'm assuming that they still did. They definitely did during Apollo, just to make sure that they weren't, that nobody had anything that was going to go around. So, but yes, a virus could get a cold. And if you went up in space, if you'd been exposed to a virus and you went up into space, you would get a cold. I think that the virus would not notice. The virus would be like, whatever. He's floating. I don't care. It's still a nose. In space, you tend to have a bit of a stuffy nose anyway, because there's more fluid sort of migrates in the upper part of your body that normally gravity would pull down to your feet. So it would be a miserable thing, I would think, to have a cold on top of that kind of congestion. So, hopefully not too many of them have to fly with cold.
So we've got time for a couple of more questions. The gal on the left here.
Did you do any research on space tourism?
No, not per se. I didn't. I was really looking at, you know, the physiology and psychology and the whole what goes into preparing for space. So tourism, no, I didn't actually. I didn't spend any time on that. I'd love to be one. I can tell you that.
One of your previous books was Bonk,
yeah.
a great title. And in that spirit, there are rumors that one of the unexpected effects of weightlessness is that the physiologic engorgement of genitals.
Uh-huh.
Is that a cosmic myth? Or is that
yes, it is, and I'll tell you why. I'm glad you brought that up, so to speak. Okay. In zero gravity, you have more fluid in the upper part of your body, and because gravity isn't sort of pulling it down to your feet, and the cutoff point is they call it the line of hydrostatic indifference, right around your diaphragm. So the male jumblies, as some guy at NASA put it, are below that. So they would be getting less fluid, blood, whatever, than on Earth. So in fact, you'd have less of an erection. If anything. And the Apollo astronauts, Buzz Aldrin, I think it was, commented on the lack of activity down there. So much for that myth. But I did read, there's a line in one of the memoirs, like, I could have drilled through kryptonite, you know, like. So there are dissenting opinions.
We can leave it at the Superman reference. Please join me in thanking Mary Roach.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.